"She will not be kept on file for obvious reasons," he says, as he makes a cross with his fingers and erases the best moment in my life so far. "Be very careful, Bram," he warns, or maybe threatens. It's hard to tell as he makes his way towards the door. "You might be the best pilot we have, but you are by no means irreplaceable. Should you become problematic, the fact that you are my son will be irrelevant." The door swishes open, and he leaves me alone to ponder.
Chapter 15. Eve. It's like we've pressed pause in the dome. A cloud has descended upon us and refused to clear. It feels wrong to laugh, smile, eat, to hold a single meaningless conversation that might lighten our hearts and encourage normality. Mother Nina's murder has given us a serious reality check in terms of what's at stake, but also hit me with a grief I've never experienced before. Not only have I never witnessed the horror of a human dying before my eyes, but I'd never had anyone so close to me taken away like that. Even though I've experienced the loss of other mothers, women who were in their 80s or 90s, none was as important to me as Mother Nina. Our bond was special. My mother, Corinne, died during childbirth, and my father, Ernie, was sectioned after losing the plot following my mother's death. I did not and do not feel the same emotional turmoil over their absences as I do at Mother Nina's. Maybe it's because it's fresher and raw. Or maybe because it's real, not something I've been told about as though I'm in a history class learning of my past. I remember the day Vivian told me of my own parents and what happened to them. I'd been asking the mothers which of them was my real mother, so the topic needed to be addressed. My birth had put too much of a physical strain on Corinne's body, which shouldn't have come as a huge surprise. She was older than most childbearing women from decades before. Vivian told me how hard they tried to save her. She was the first woman in 50 years to bear a female, so it stands to reason that they would do all they could to keep her alive. But sadly, she slipped away. I'm told it was peaceful and that I was placed in her arms at the time. I've always found comfort in that, even if I have no recollection of it. The situation with my father is slightly different. I don't really remember him either, but I know he tried to kidnap me when I was 3, which led to him being cut off entirely. I'm regularly reminded of the incident because of the moon-shaped scar he caused on my wrist, a little rough patch that I always catch myself rubbing. Probably out of habit. I don't remember much about the episode, other than a door creaking open in the dark, a hand grabbing mine and pulling me from my bed. Lots of shouting and confusion, a scuffle, and then his tormented face at the sight of my bloodied arm as they dragged him away. I don't know how much of it is true or whether I dreamt it. Dreams distort, stretch, and obscure the line between what is real and what is not. All I can say with complete certainty is that I dream of my father most nights. Vivian has briefed me on him too, mostly about what happened when I was last in his company. She's told me little about my ancestry. She said they were keen for my father to be a key figure in my life growing up, but it was too tough for him to be around me. I've been told he blamed me for the loss of his wife. Hardly surprising. They were reportedly happy before she fell pregnant with me. That changed everything, apparently. I've been sleeping with my mother's book under my pillow for the last 3 nights, but I haven't found the courage to open it. I don't want her words tarnished by my fresh heartache. She's often with my father in my dreams, although I've only seen Corinne in pictures they've given me, and in video clips of her in interviews. Her happiness shines through as she rubs her bump lovingly. None of the clips are long enough to give me a real sense of what's being discussed, but I've watched them a lot. I've studied them, just like I have those of the potentials. I look nothing like her. I'm identical to my father. Mother Nina filled the void my parents left behind. The thought of not being able to see her ever again, of her not being the first person I see every morning, of never being able to say a proper goodbye or thank her for everything she's done for me, including giving her own life, is crushing. Despite my early numbness, I have cried solidly since Vivian left my room, allowing me to wallow in Mother Nina's death. My soul feels black and heavy as the clothes they've allowed me to wear. I am in mourning. I've stayed in my bedroom, not caring to venture out. I've just sat here, consumed with guilt and sorrow. Every time there's been a knock at my door, I've momentarily forgotten the terror and expected to see Mother Nina walking in. But now, the time has come to end that ridiculous hope and lay her to rest. Vivian has done as she promised and is allowing us to say goodbye in a way we feel shows gratitude and love for Mother Nina. Minutes ahead of the proceedings starting, I sit out on the drop, needing a moment or two of quiet reflection before I have to say goodbye. My eyes are fixed on the clouds as I sense Holly move along the walkway behind me and lower herself next to me. She doesn't say hello. She doesn't try to force conversation or coax out how I'm feeling so that they can psychoanalyze my mental state. She just sits and allows me to be. That's how I know it's her. Him. Bram. I send a mental thank you to those in charge for allowing me my Holly again on what feels like the hardest day of my life so far. I can't look at her, but just having her here is enough. The silence is comforting. It's what I need. I close my eyes and breathe it in. Come on, I croak, a gentle reminder that I've barely spoken over the last few days. We better go in. They'll be waiting. I get to my feet. I'm hit with heartache as I look towards the building and know that I'm walking in to say goodbye. I take a slow breath, trying to stop the tears falling as I breathe out and look to the heavens above me. I'm here, Holly says, so quietly it's as though I've imagined it. Swallowing the lump in my throat, I nod. I appreciate the gesture. With my next breath out, I manage to place one foot in front of the other and lead us back through the upper garden zone, just as the rest of the mothers start to gather. Like Holly and me, they're all in black and look somber, yet somehow they smile and we exchange hugs. We're unified in our loss and grief. We're not waiting long before Mother Tabia steps forward. Her graying black hair has been pinned into her usual low bun, yet the air of superiority seems to have left her. Today she's mourning like the rest of us. As usual after a mother's death, she cradles a white ceramic pot. There is no body. Instead, the pot holds a few of the mother's favorite possessions, items that brought her joy while they were here, usually photos or jewelry, little keepsakes from a former life sealed into an urn, symbolizing the woman she was. A few days ago, a terribly unjust thing happened in the worst way imaginable, Mother Tabia says, taking charge while protectively pulling the pot closer to her chest. While we may feel that we don't want to move forward, we have to remember that life is ever-evolving, ever-changing. Nina experienced love and kindness in her previous life, which enabled her to spread her goodness here. We were fortunate to have her walk among us, and must take note of all her attributes. While she talks, I think of our friend and long to be set free from the grief, but I miss her too much. I shuffle on the spot, shrugging my shoulders and trying to ease the weight bearing down on them. I'm going to pass this around, Mother Tabia says, her dark eyes looking down at the container in her hands and raising it a few inches. I'm sure most of you will echo my own anguish at never having had a chance to say a proper farewell to our Nina. I know that's how Eve feels, she says, looking at me with the saddest of smiles. She's been in to see me regularly over the last 3 days. She might be the strictest of the mothers and easily influenced by Vivian, but she's listened to me and tried to coax me out of the darkness. So, as you find this in your own hands, she continues, think of how she made you feel. Thank her. Will the love she radiated to shine through us all, always. With that, she closes her eyes with a frown, as though she's struggling with her own emotions while communicating with some higher being. I'm still watching her as the faint lines around her eyes soften and smooth. A peaceful expression takes over her dark skin as she grins, white teeth flashing. She opens her eyes and passes the object to Mother Cardi, and then on across the group. I watch as the same acceptance and tranquility befalls them. When it is my turn, I almost feel scared to touch the pot, just in case I'm unable to absorb the comfort it's given them. But I take it from Mother Kimberly and pull it into my breast, my arms wrapping around it. I can't remember the last hug Mother Nina and I shared, and the thought saddens me. Was it on the morning of her death? I'm not sure. We spoke of love and her past. I wish I'd hugged her more, like I did when I was younger. I wish I'd been more grateful. I wish I'd shown her more often how much she meant to me. The thoughts of her looking after me fill my heart with gratitude and joy, not sadness. I was loved, as was she. A smile of acceptance stretches my lips. A thank you. A goodbye. I open my eyes and turn to hand the container to the person next to me, but when I open my eyes, Holly is looking at the pot regretfully, her brows knitted. She can't take it. In that moment, I don't feel clever in catching out the system and their trickery. I don't feel smug at the awkwardness created as the mothers rush in and try to cover up the mistake. I feel sorry for her, because she should have been able to put to rest her thoughts of Mother Nina, too. She'd be glad you came, I tell her, uttering the words like they're some sort of consolation prize while cringing at myself. She shrugs and nods at the floor, a movement that isn't very Holly. I wish I could give her the same comfort she offers me. Not her, but him. I'm not sure I know where Holly ends and Bram begins. I've spent years trying to figure it out, but meeting him has thrown me. He was so different from Holly in so many ways, yet he was familiar. Hardly surprising given the amount of time we spent together over the years. I do know the person standing beside me, and I wish I could console her, him. Once Mother Tabia has the pot back in her arms, she starts singing, a lullaby Mother Nina used to croon to me when I was younger. Everyone joins in, even Holly. I asked for this song to be included. It talks of a bird with broken wings being set free. That's how I want to think of her today, learning to fly. It gives me hope and fills me with love. Thank you, everyone, Mother Tabia says at the end, indicating with a wave of her hand that we can disperse. Where has she gone? I ask, before anyone has had a chance to move. To her husband, she replies. I thought he was... No, she says firmly, shaking her head, blushing at the awkward silence that's fallen around us. He'll be happy to have her back. I'm happy Mother Nina is back where her heart was. But, not for the first time, I'm seeing the holes in information I've been given. The lies. I'm sure someone thinks it's for my own good to shield me from a world I know nothing of. But suddenly I'm feeling like an actor in a play. I know my own lines, but everyone else knows theirs, mine, and has read the entire play. I want to get my hands on the script and find out what else is being hidden from me. I want to know more about the world my children will be born into and the life we shall lead if I succeed in helping the rebirth. I want to know the truth. When people slip away to their chores, I wander back towards the drop, my mind still full of questions. What did you think of Mother Nina? I ask Holly, sensing her a couple of feet behind me. I slow down so she can catch up. She was one of the good ones, she sighs. She was the closest thing I had to an actual mother, I say, looking across to gauge her reaction. I understand that, she nods, her lips pursed. Do you? I ask, looking from her mouth to his familiar eyes. I stare into them as hard as I can, willing the shape to melt away so I can see his true form. What are your parents like? Tell me about them. My mum is a seamstress and my dad a teacher, she says, her voice monotonous at the repetition of the same story. They were quite surprised when they... I don't want that answer. I stop her, frustrated at the continued lie. That's not what I asked. What are your parents like? Yours. Her head snaps around to mine. She answers without skipping a beat. I had to leave my mum when I was little. My father is controlling. Our relationship is difficult. The hurt on her face lets me know she's telling the truth, not sticking to the rules or the scripts she's been fed. I wish I had that. Seriously? One row with my dad and you'd change your mind, she scoffs. Maybe. Maybe not, I shrug. You share the same blood. You were made from him, created by him. That must count for something. She looks crestfallen, and as if she's about to say more, but as we reach the end of the drop and return to our sitting positions from earlier, she decides against it. Parents love with no agenda or judgment. I wish I'd been born in different times. Then mine might still be with me, I say, sharing thoughts I've never expressed before, a hankering for a love I've never known. The sound of music from the speakers inside tells me it's dinner time. Already, I mutter, annoyed that I can't sit here longer. Holly gives a little laugh and I realize the joke is on me. It's dinner time because they want this conversation to end. Of course they're listening. Want to come for dinner? I ask cheekily, glancing at her as I bring my shoulders up in an inviting manner. For all the years Holly has been my best friend, I've never seen her eat. It didn't take me long to understand that her absence from meals meant she was unable to consume food like I can. I have to get back. Time for me to go, I say. Yes. And for you to leave. For now, she smiles, making no effort to leave the spot in which she's sitting. What happens if I don't go? I'm not particularly hungry anyway, I say. I'll be back, Eve, she says. Yes, I say, hoping beyond hope that she will. Thanks for being with me today, I add, getting to my feet. Of course, she says, her eyes blinking slowly as she gives me a sad smile. I couldn't have done it without you. Well, actually, I could have. Thanks, she laughs. But I'm glad I didn't have to. I laugh too. I understand. She doesn't look offended. You don't need me. Perhaps not. But I like having you around, I admit, my voice lowering. You're not like the others. Thanks, she mutters, a smile on her perfect lips. I turn and leave as heat crosses my cheeks. I'm blushing. I pick up my Rubik's Cube from the bowl that's been placed beyond the glass doors for my belongings, then head for dinner, all the while trying to ignore the fluttering in my tummy.
Chapter 16. Bram. The dome fades in my visor. And you're clear, Hartman mutters in my earpiece. I sense a slight wobble in his voice and the line opens again as though he's about to say something else, but I don't hear what it is. My head is yanked back violently, the visor ripped from my face. The blue glow from the scanners inside illuminates the hard, creased face of my attacker. Dr. Wells! Hartman shouts as his silhouette leaps over his control desk in my peripheral vision and bounds across the studio towards me and my father. He won't make it in time. The visor comes crashing towards my face faster than I can react. The state-of-the-art technology smashes into the side of my head, showering me with glass. The projectors inside malfunction with the impact and throw shards of light around the room. The studio walls shine brightly with the sunset I witnessed with Eve just moments ago, but as my dad's fist reloads for a second round, the deep reds on the horizon don't seem so hopeful anymore. I hit the floor. It's still warm from the motors that have been running underneath. I look up to see Hartman failing to hold my father back. As his fist approaches for the final time, I'm comforted by Eve's image projected across the ceiling. She's there to help me through. I close my eyes. It's dark. I race to keep up with the man I barely know who has taken me away from my life. Too scared to cry. Not in front of my father. You're lucky to have a father in your life. My mother's husky voice whispers in my mind, helping to calm me. The Velcro straps on my shoes are unstuck, soaked in the floodwater lapping at the walkway as we approach the mountain ahead. A flash of lightning electrifies the clouds and I suddenly realize it isn't a mountain. It's a building. Three enormous letters above the entrance come into view as the lowest layer of thin cloud disperses in a gust of wind. E-P-O. Do only as I tell you, my father says, as a beam of light scans his eyes and a set of heavy glass doors slides open, letting us into a cavernous entrance hall. Good morning, Dr. Wells, a young woman says from behind the desk. I pause at the sight of her. She's like nothing I've ever seen before. Daddy, her face is smooth, I say, admiring her perfect complexion. That's enough now, no talking, my father says. But Daddy, why is she... Enough, my father snaps. I keep silent, but I watch the woman with complete fascination. She stares at a computer screen from behind her desk, her fingers typing something on the keyboard. That's when I notice that her fingers aren't pressing any keys. They graze the tops of the square letter pads but apply no pressure. Miss Silva is expecting you. You are cleared to ascend to the summit once you are through security. You too, young man. She flashes me a smile, and I see a small smudge of her red lipstick on her teeth. How old are you? She asks kindly. I am 4, I reply proudly. She smiles. Thank you, Stephanie, my father says. How do you like your new job? Very much, Dr. Wells. Thank you again, she replies with the same smile. She's young. Younger than my mother. I've never seen any woman like her before. My father walks away. I pick up my suitcase again and scramble after him. Security checks everything in my case. Every toy. Every book. Once we're through, we board a lift and begin our ascent. Ouch! I complain as my ears pop. Don't worry. I doubt you'll be coming and going from here very often, my father says, noticing my discomfort. Daddy, the lady, why was she different? I ask. My father smiles. It's not an expression I'd seen on his face many times before. Different how? He asks, seeming genuinely interested in me for the first time today. I take a moment to think how best to describe it. She's pretty, I say. My father chuckles. Indeed, very pretty for a dead woman, he says. Dead? I ask, not understanding. Yes, Stephanie, the real Stephanie, is dead. The person you just met was not real, just a projection of reality. He smiles. I don't understand what he's saying. The lift doors open and I step into my new home for the first time, but one question pops into my mind. Did I just talk to a ghost? When I open my eyes, I'm blinded by an intense white light. It's cold, and my body itches under whatever material is pulled over me. Shh, I've nearly finished, my dear, a soft voice says kindly from somewhere behind the light. Must have been quite a malfunction. Malfunction? I ask. The voice is female, so I'm not on one of the medical floors. I can only be in the dome. Yes, the report says that the equipment malfunctioned in the studio during shutdown. Don't worry if you can't remember. It's quite normal for some memory loss after a head injury, the mother explains. Can't work out who she is. Her face is hidden behind the light she's working with. So that's the spin he's put on this little accident, is it? I chuckle. He? The mother asks. Dr. Wells, my father. Well, I'm afraid I don't have any more information about the accident to give you, young man. But whatever happened, you need to rest, she orders as she finishes the final stitch on my forehead. She switches off the blinding circular light and I finally catch a glimpse of the fine wrinkles that decorate her face. Mother Cardi, I say, sitting up slightly so I can look at her properly. Her marble-like eyes have a watery shimmer, reflecting the room. It's a magical quality, almost enchanting. Her thinning skin radiates experience and knowledge as her lips curl into a motherly smile. Her face is a story, each wrinkle a sentence written into her skin over time, beckoning you to read it, to study it. I thought I told you to rest, she says. I will. I was just wondering why I'm here and not on one of the medical floors below. I sound casual. I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that question either. When Miss Silva gives us an order, we simply obey, she says calmly, walking towards the door followed by two other women who I hadn't seen in the shadows. Mothers Tabia and Kimberly. Even unconscious, beaten half to death, a man is not trusted to be alone with a woman, especially not in the dome. Not after the potential number 2 disaster. Rest. Miss Silva will be in to see you in a few moments, Mother Cardi says as she leaves the room. The door hisses shut and the lock clicks, sealing me inside. She places her hand on the glass and I catch her eye as the glass begins to frost. Just before its transparency fades completely, she gives me a subtle, comforting wink. I'm not sure what it means, but it fills me with a warmth as my head hits the pillow. I'm trying not to think about what Miss Silver's visit might entail. I'm standing on the drop, dangling my feet over the edge as I look down at the distant city below. My shoes swing back and forth as I watch hundreds of workers study each pixel on the screens, cleaning and replacing them in preparation for Eve's first day in the dome. As my foot swings back, it catches on the bottom of the metallic ledge and my shoe slips from my small foot, falling into the world below. Suddenly it stops, hovering in midair just a few meters below the drop, caught in a seemingly invisible force field. The workers are too busy to notice. I turn to see my father and Vivian speaking at the other end of the walkway, arguing, it seems, from my father's flushed cheeks. I look back down at my floating shoe. I think I can get it. I climb over the railings that surround the drop and stand on the polished metal, but my sock slips and I fall. Although I'm aware of the illusion, my body still reacts as though I'm plummeting to my death. It's an awful sensation, and I let out a small yelp. I hit the screens hard, and the ones I'm lying on flicker under my weight. I look up. No one's noticed. The team of lab-coated men obsessively polishing the screens are too preoccupied with their task. I stand and take a step. Then another. I'm walking across the fake sky, each step feeling unnatural as my feet shatter the illusion they are building for Eve. I reach down and pick up my lost shoe. Bram, a distant voice calls. I look around and see no one. Bram, it calls again as I slip on my shoe. The voice seems familiar. Bram, Vivian screams. Or is it my father? Perhaps both. I look up and they have seen me. The game is up. I'm in trouble now. Bram! I sit up in shock. Bram! Vivian Silver is standing at the foot of the bed. Bad dream? She asks, as I try to calm my breathing. Yeah, one of those that feel real when you don't remember falling asleep, I explain. Those are my favorite, she replies, running her fingers across the metal bed frame. Those dreams are the only escape from this reality sometimes. She looks troubled. I've not seen her like this before. It doesn't suit her. Your father is a complicated man. She changes the subject abruptly, not looking me in the eye. I've known Miss Silver since I was a kid, when she first employed my father and we moved to the tower, but I don't see her much now. Of course, she's a busy woman. Being responsible for halting the extinction of the human race has made her the most powerful person on the planet. Governments obey her. Royalty bow to her. Religious figures fear her. Getting a meeting with her is near impossible, so spending quality time with me is hardly at the top of her list of priorities. It means I don't know her like I used to, but I can still sense when something's not quite right. I know he does things sometimes that are crazy, I interrupted her, which I've never done before. I don't think many people interrupt her. Out of line, she continues calmly. Sometimes his actions are uncalled for. His temper uncontrollable, and the way he treats you can be unacceptable, but he's trying his best to deal with the pressure we all face. Unfortunately, as his son, you get the physical fallout of that pressure. Yeah, and I've got the scars to prove it, I say, pointing to the bandage covering my forehead. Vivian looks away, as though she's almost ashamed to see me like this. You know your father better than anyone, Bram. He likes to control things, for life to be planned and predictable. When events don't go smoothly, when life isn't the way he planned it, he finds it difficult to deal with. Particularly when that involves you, Bram. She swipes her hand and audio starts playing. It's Holly's voice. My voice, as Eve hears it. My father is controlling. Our relationship is difficult. Vivian swipes again and it stops. I bow my head in shame. Not only did I break protocol, I criticize my father openly for everyone watching to hear. I imagine those words would be difficult to take from your son, Vivian suggests. They are also potentially extremely damaging for Eve. I know, I'm sorry. I say honestly, it won't happen again. It won't. It mustn't, Vivian commands, suddenly seeming more like the woman I know. This is a warning, Bram. Not from your father, from me. I won't play games with you. I won't hit you. But if you break protocol again, there will be serious repercussions for you and for Hartman. Is that clear? Yes, Miss Silver, I say, like a naughty schoolboy in front of the headmistress. Once you have recovered, you will be escorted back to your dorm, and today's event will not be discussed with anyone. She walks towards the door, which swishes open automatically. Rest, my boy, she says as she disappears into the dome. The frosted glass door closes and locks behind her. She's never spoken to me like that before. Years of running this place have made her cold. But I guess even the thickest ice has cracks.
Chapter 17. Eve. My step is lighter, yet more determined, on the stairs leading up to my room after dinner. For days I've had this heaviness hanging over me, but sending Mother Nina off today and being able to thank her has left me less encumbered with guilt and sadness. Hope begins to regrow. The questions that have formed over the last few days invigorate me into moving forward, as does my Holly. I've become increasingly aware of how much I value that friendship and enjoy being with her. The knowledge that she is Bram hasn't drifted far from my mind, so I want to start figuring out what is going on in this building. It's because I'm feeling like this that I go to my bed and reach beneath my pillow. I pull out my mother's notebook, my fingertips stroking the front cover. Opening the page, I reread the first entry, then turn to the next. I've been here before. Not with a girl, but with a boy. 7 boys, in fact. I'm sad to say that each of your brothers died in utero. I birthed them all and wept while I held their frail bodies in my arms before they were taken from me. I was so heartbroken. The grief overwhelmed me. I'd failed at being a mother, even though I never got to do the things that mothers should, like changing nappies, worrying over when to give solid food, or hearing my children tell me they loved me. Instead, I got nothing but dispiriting loss. Our dream of having children began to appear impossible, even though no one could tell your father and me what was happening and why we were having to say goodbye to those tiny souls so prematurely. We gave up hope. We couldn't risk the same thing happening again and again. My body was considered useless, so my doctor and the team at the hospital wrote me off, like an old car with a faulty engine. We said we were happy not to try again, to leave it there. I couldn't face another goodbye. I couldn't face another midwife giving me that look at yet another routine scan. I couldn't bear to go through another fruitless labor. I felt weak, unhappy, and empty. I had to let go of that dream. It wasn't easy, but once the decision was made, I felt relieved not to be consumed with longing. Your father and I fell deeper in love, something I'd never thought possible. He loved me in spite of my flaws and failings. He loved me. We've been happy. Really so very, very happy. A month ago, I went to the doctor. I was constantly bloated, my breasts were hurting. I was having regular mood swings and was often a little nauseous. A lot of my girlfriends had been going through the change, so I'd been putting it all down to that. But I was worried it was something more and wanted to know for certain. I laughed so hard when the doctor handed me a pregnancy test. Your dad said he heard me from the waiting room. I dutifully peed and headed back to the doctor without waiting for the result. I even handed it to her with an air of, "This is ridiculous." I didn't expect her to say yes just as I thought and send me off to be scanned, but that was exactly what happened. In that moment, I felt fearful and anxious as I collected your father and went to the specialist. Pregnant again. I cried. Your father did too. We were in shock. Then, within seconds, we were laughing in each other's arms, unable to believe this had happened when we hadn't planned it. It felt like a gift. I held my breath as the technician glided her ultrasound stick over my skin while looking at the screen in front of her. I know I was preparing myself for the worst, because that was what I knew from past experience. All hope and joy eradicated when she muttered the inevitable, "I'm sorry." But the stick kept moving, and she kept clicking away at the keypad, locking in numbers and measurements. The gasp was almost comical. "I'll be right back," she said, all fingers and thumbs, the stick wobbling out of her hand and landing on the floor. Your father and I looked at each other in confusion. I didn't feel like she was about to tell me my baby had died. It felt special. And it was. 5 minutes later, 4 other members of staff entered the room and watched the technician repeat the scan. "See?" she said, looking up at them. They all turned to me and your father. Their expressions were priceless. Honestly, I'll never forget those gaping jaws. Eventually, Vivian stepped forward and introduced herself, then said something along the lines of, "Rather remarkably, Mrs. Warren, you're expecting a girl." Your dad nearly fainted on the spot, but I just cried. Let's blame the hormones. Instead of sending us home, they asked us to stay in for a few days so I could be monitored properly. Given my history and the fact that I am having a geriatric pregnancy, geri-bloody-atric, I said yes without the slightest hesitation. That was a month ago, and I haven't left since. They haven't forced me. In fact, it was me who said I wouldn't mind having regular scans and being taken care of. Plus, it's gone crazy outside. Your dad tried to go home one day to grab some things, but there were floods of people downstairs wanting to talk to him, all asking questions about me and you. The world's gone nuts. I think we're happy here. It's safe, and Vivian's been a great help in dealing with everything so that we don't have to. So here we are. It's my 8th pregnancy. I've been here before, but this time it feels completely different. It is completely different. I can't believe I'm 6 months pregnant with a girl. I hope this is the start of things changing out there so that you can have a happy and fulfilled future. I love you so much already, and I'm doing all I possibly can to get you here safely. Love, your mama. Kiss, kiss. It's a story I've heard before, but it's so much better reading my mum's account of it. It's heartbreaking yet funny. I wonder if this is how she'd have shared the account every birthday if she was still here. Would she still go on about not having a clue she was expecting me and make me laugh by reenacting the sonographer's shocked reaction? And would she bridge the gap between Vivian and me? Mum seems to have been glad of her support, even welcoming it. She didn't seem bogged down with the pressure of what was expected of her. Instead, she sounds like a mother excitedly awaiting the birth of her baby. Another baby she would never watch growing up as she had dreamt of doing. I close the book. That's enough for now.
Chapter 18. Bram. I'm feeling better, but I'm still signed off from piloting Holly. The last 3 days I've spent inside that small room in some obscure corner of the dome have felt more like imprisonment than recovery. I guess it was a prison. I was sent there to keep me silent, to protect my father. Sending me down to medical would have raised too many suspicions. The mothers were the safest option. It broke protocol, but they don't ask questions. I'm pleased to be back in the dorm, back with Hartman. "Dude, it sucked. They've not let me leave the dorm," he explains, "for 3 days. He notices my lack of sympathy. I point to the small red mark on my forehead from my father's beating, which is now little more than some barely noticeable scar tissue, thanks to Mother Cardi's expert sewing. Of course, if I'd been sent to medical, there'd be no trace of anything, thanks to the technology they have access to, but I've never been shy of scars. I run my rough fingers over the pale, bumpy skin on the back of my left hand. I'm 10 years old again, and my father lashes down on my knuckles. My tears don't stop him. "You must never speak about yourself to Eve," he growls through his clenched teeth. "You are not Bram when you are with her. You are not my son when you are with her. You are not my son. You are not my son." I'm back in our dorm, rubbing my hands. Eve's not the only one with a physical reminder of her father. "Jeez, he hit you hard this time, Bram," Hartman says, lowering his voice. "They all hurt the same," I shrug. A slip of paper slides under the thin gap beneath our door. Hartman and I look at each other. "An assignment? Are we allowed to get back to work at last?" "Briefing, tonight, 1900 hours. Hartman says, reading the single line of typed instructions from the paper. He looks at me and smiles. I guess we're back. The briefing room is alive with the usual whispered excitement that follows any unforeseen event in the tower. That Hartman and I have been mysteriously absent for 3 days has not gone unnoticed. "Hey, Bram, I read the transcript from your last session," Jackson calls over the noise. "Playing pretty close to the line, aren't you?" I don't give him the satisfaction of an answer. "What line is that?" Hartman replies. "Great, here we go. Getting into discussions about her parents, your parents, it's all a little real for my liking," Jackson says while digging chunks of his dinner from his teeth with a toothpick. "Well, who gives a shit about your liking, Jackson?" Hartman fans the flames. "Be careful, is all I'm saying," Jackson warns, not bothering to look at us. "You care about us now, Jackson?" Hartman asks sarcastically. "Look, I don't know where you two have been hiding for the past few days, but I imagine it has something to do with what was said in the last session. No one gets away with breaking protocol so blatantly without punishment. Rumor has it that you've been holed up in some ward for psychiatric treatment, Bram. That true? Getting things off your chest about your difficult relationship?" Jackson mocks. "And where did those rumors start?" my father says, entering the room behind us. The squad shuffle in their seats awkwardly, instantly becoming more alert and professional in his presence. My heart sinks at the sight of him. It's the first time I've seen him since, and I realize I'm touching my head. I snatch my hand away and shake off the memory. "There's too much at stake to waste energy on rumors and lies. This is not the academy. You are not children. You are young men at the epicenter of the most important moment in the history of our species. And your personal issues are of zero importance in comparison to the challenge we face. Now suck it up and let's get to work," my father commands. I can't help but feel that his words were meant for me alone. Suck it up and get to work. That was his apology. "Potential number three," he begins, wasting no time as he flashes up an image of a young man we've not seen before. "Although potential is no longer appropriate, as it's absolutely necessary that this partnership is successful." My father talks us through potential number three's family history, his genetics, his political value, his fertility, his beliefs and morals. He has been vetted, cross-checked, analyzed, trained and briefed down to the most detailed level. He is, if it were at all possible, the most perfect match for Eve we have found to date. "On paper," I interrupt. A few heads turn slightly and shoot me awkward looks. "Do you have something to add, Bram?" my father asks. The room falls silent. "Well, it's just that..." Suddenly I feel unsure of the words flowing from my mouth. "That it's not about his intelligence or genetics. That's not what relationships are based on." "Go on," my dad nods. "So it doesn't matter if we fill Eve's head with how perfectly meant to be this or that one is. She's a young woman with a mind and a heart of her own." Jackson forces a laugh, which I try my best to ignore. "She can't be controlled like that. After what happened last time, you can't just shove her into a room with one of these guys and expect them to play happy families," I finish. "Thank you, Bram," my father says calmly. "That's why we won't be asking them to do that. It is no longer an option." The squad listen intently. Seems that everyone is as eager as I am to find out what the new plan is. "Things are going to take a more scientific approach from now on. Eve is required to have no emotional relationship with potential number three. She doesn't even need to meet him if she doesn't wish to. We simply need her cooperation, her compliance, and the procedure will be simple and painless. If it's successful, she could be pregnant next month, which is the time frame we are currently working towards." My father has finished, standing in front of images showing various statistics and figures about potential number three's impressive genetic compatibility with Eve. We take a moment to absorb the new plan, the approach we need to adopt to persuade Eve to comply with it. "Pregnant within a month and she's not even required to meet him," I call. "Is that the way our future begins? Are those the foundations humanity is to rebuild on?" I feel the stares of my fellow pilots, obviously not sharing my discomfort with this new arrangement. "Any future is better than none at all," my father says, looking deep into my eyes.
"Is it?"
I reply.
Chapter 19. Eve. It sounds so scientific and cold, I moan, turning to Holly, who's been lying across the sofa in my room, listening to me vent ever since I left Vivian's office in a rage 10 minutes ago. It's fair to say the encounters haven't been my main focus over the last week, which is odd for me, seeing as I've been working towards them for as long as I can remember. Instead, I've been preoccupied with thoughts of my parents, Mother Nina, Bram, Holly, Michael, and dealing with the unanswered questions in my mind whilst trying to understand what's going on. It seems what is going on is the successful pairing of me and potential number 3, even though we've never met. As potentials 1 and 2 have been discounted, I have no idea what they've done with Diego's body and don't care. I'm stuck with the last option on their shortlist. I wasn't too shocked by that piece of information, as it seems the obvious thing for them to decide when they're eager to get things moving. I've been told I don't have to meet potential number 3 at all. There'd be no room full of people standing around as we spoke for the first time, no smoke and mirrors tactics to vet him. The vital parts of us would come together in a laboratory, the embryos placed later in my womb to incubate and grow. I remember Vivian coming to my room 2 years ago and telling me what would happen after the initial meetings with the potentials. I'd pick my favorite and would then be permitted to meet him as often as I liked. At the right time, when my body was ready, the revival would occur. When she revealed what his body would do to mine, I was terrified. "We'll be there with you," she said, in an attempt to console me, although the thought of the mothers bearing witness to that act didn't comfort me. Since then, plans for the revival have become more elaborate and detailed, with a week-long ceremony to mark the first stage of the rebirth. During this time, I'd come to see the importance and necessity of the deed. No longer am I so bashful at the thought. After all Vivian's preparation, I was surprised to hear her altered plans. Scrapping the ceremony and opting for a scientific route is a dramatic move and vastly different from how I was created. "There'll be fewer variables this way, less chance of human error," she said, when it was clear I didn't understand why things were changing. "It's your decision, of course." "Mine?" I practically choked. I didn't fail to notice the pleasure on her face. Now Holly remains tight-lipped. I know exactly what she's doing. She's letting me get it all out so she can sweep in and rationalize everything for me once I've done with my frantic thoughts. She knows there's no point in interrupting me when I'm like this, as I won't listen, and I know she'll have had a fair idea of what was going to happen in Vivian's room before I did, so she'll have been ready for this reaction. Expecting it, even. It's no coincidence that I've been told about the new procedure on the same day that my Holly has returned after a few days off. It'll all be part of their plan. I've missed her. Him. I know they've been punishing me by keeping him away and leaving me with the other 2 for company. It'll have been Vivian's way of reminding me that she's in charge of who comes in and out of the dome and what goes on here. Mother Nina's death is no excuse for challenging behavior. Not when we've been hit by a major security issue and they've had to rethink plans that have been years in the making. Vivian is signalling that I have to respect the boundaries they've laid out for me, not be so ungrateful or cheeky. And I was incredibly cheeky. Asking about the person behind their technology was certainly bold of me. Brazen, even. Going on to admit how much I liked his company was plain foolish on a variety of levels. It was the first time I've actually admitted out loud that I know Holly isn't a real person. Although they can't think I'm that dumb, surely. I'm the first and only girl born in 50 years. Who is Holly meant to be if they want me to believe she's real? Not that I've ever cared that she isn't. It's never mattered. Like I've said before, I've always been glad of the company. But now I know that a large part of her is very real. Right now, I'm acutely aware that Bram is controlling her, and that the only way I get to continue having contact with him is through her. I feel disloyal, having reached that realization, as though I'm using Holly to get closer to him, but that's not true. I've purposefully not asked for him to join me here, and tried my hardest not to schedule extra trips to the drop in the hope of seeing him. I've allowed them to control when he's with me. I've managed not to ask after my Holly or point out that things aren't running according to our normal schedules. I've resisted temptation, which hasn't been the easiest thing to do when I'm starting to see through the cracks. I think of my mother and wonder whether I'm wrong to doubt the life they've built for me when she was so willing to be here. She put her faith in them and trusted Vivian. She must have had good cause to. Plus, I can't ignore the fact they're allowing me to make a decision about my future. A decision that'll affect all of us. But then I think of Michael and how he didn't try to spoil me, of Mother Nina and her husband, and of Bram and Holly, and wonder whether I've ever really made a decision, or had a true thought, when the facts I've been given have been tampered with. My reality has holes in it. I need to start poking around so that I can see things a little more clearly. So, when it comes to making this decision about potential number three and dismissing the ceremony, I'm dubious as to whether or not it's all a trick. Whether they're trying to coax me into agreeing to something for their own benefit, or whether it's genuinely up to me. If the decision were truly my own, regardless of all the other thoughts littering my brain, I still wouldn't be sure of what I wanted. The encounters have lost all their appeal. I don't know if I'm open to going through another after two truly horrific experiences. Perhaps letting science do its thing would make things easier. Perhaps I should allow them to extract and reposition my eggs once they've been fertilized by potential number three's winning sperm. It simply doesn't seem as special as the revival ceremony I've been preparing for. It all seems so sudden, I say, my hands working on the Rubik's Cube in the hope that it'll ease the frustration and anxiety I'm currently feeling. Eve, she sighs, her fingers twiddling the ends of her hair. We're not talking about meeting a potential, just about being fast-tracked through and partnered up due to a series of failures. Whether I meet him or not, I could be pregnant within weeks. I don't know if I'm ready, I whisper, turning to her with my hand over my heart, my face anxiously screwed up. It's overwhelming, she notes calmly, barely moving. Yes. I've continued reading my mum's words, and it's become blindingly obvious how prepared she was to have me. Things haven't happened for me as I'd always thought they would, so I don't feel that way. I'm like a little girl still. Not like a mother at all. The outcome and desired results are still the same as before, Eve. That's not changed, Holly says, closing her eyes. They're just looking at new ways of achieving the prolonged existence of our race without putting the only hope we have of survival in danger. The prolonged existence of our race? Have you heard yourself? You're talking about a baby, my baby, I say, forgetting for a second that this is my Holly. Mum seemed so jolly and upbeat in her letters. She doesn't seem bogged down by pressure or as though she's struggling to cope with the world expecting her to deliver its saviour. She sounds like a happy mum, excited to meet her daughter. Our outlook is so different. It pains me that the one woman who could have shared some of my anxieties can't hear them. You won't be forced into the same awful position as last time, Holly says, sitting up while offering an apologetic look. They don't want the same mistakes to be made. I should think not, I grumble. They want you to be comfortable. Yeah, right. They do, she says, and adds softly, I do. My heart does a little dance. Part of me knows that I should be wary. This Holly could still be a part of their plan. But I can't stop the way she makes me feel. I've always loved being around her, but now I know Bram is saying these words. I can't help imagining him here with me, supporting me and caring for me. So, do you want to meet him? She asks, breaking into my thoughts as she takes a deep breath in and reclines once more. I don't know. Is there any real need for a conversation between him and me? I frown, the weight of the decision slamming down on me and my emotions. Does it matter if I like him? And by like him, I mean simply find him agreeable. I'm not holding out hope for much more than that, given who they previously paired me with. I mean, who was in charge of vetting them? Did they just pick names out of a hat? Holly throws her head back and laughs. It's not the cute little giggle I'm accustomed to. It's bigger, bolder. It has to be more him. I like it. Oh, I need some air, I huff, putting down the Rubik's Cube and stalking out of the door, arms swinging rigid at my sides. I can't bear my room any longer. Here I'm trapped in my whirlwind of thoughts. Come on, I call behind me. Whether or not she's here to give me guidance, I don't want her to leave me just yet. Not when she's been gone for so long. Coming, she calls, jumping to attention and trailing my heels as we follow the path to our usual spot. My bedroom, the dining room, the classroom, the drop. That's all I ever see, other than a cold examination room and the occasional trip to my spot outside. It's my routine and it's all I know. It's all they've allowed me to see. Over the years, I've felt trepidation over what will take place in these few weeks and this first year. But now it's arrived, my anxiety runs in a way I've never expected. I don't want my greater understanding of the world to come after I fall pregnant. I don't want to feel I've only got half of the picture when providing the world with my offspring. I don't want knowledge and understanding to come too late. There's no rush to decide, Holly says, as she lowers herself with no regard for the drop below us. Today, she's wearing the most girly outfit I've ever seen her in. Baby pink jeans, a cerise skin-tight top with tassels, and silver glittery jelly wedges. Someone is trying to erase the fact that she's a he, but all I can think of is that Bram is underneath, wearing his lycra bodysuit, dictating her every move. What do you think I should do? I ask, the pleading whine in my voice making me shudder. I want her opinion. I can't answer that. But you always do, I say, shocked as I turn to her. No, I don't. She frowns. Seriously? You can be quite persuasive, I squeal. I'm sure you've talked me into numerous things over the years. Eve, are you going to deny it? I challenge. She looks a little hurt and uncomfortable. I never make you do anything you don't want to, Eve, do I? No, I guess not, I say, not wanting to offend her and wishing I could nudge her shoulder affectionately to check in with her that she's okay. But you always have an opinion to share. This is different. It has to be your decision, she says, her face not losing its frown. Your choice. It's your body. I can't imagine what it would be like to do either. What, science or intercourse? I blush. Not because it's the choice I'm faced with, but because I'm speaking about the revival with my Holly. Once more, the sight of his face and sweaty, muscular body stirs in my memory. I don't think I'd find the decision so difficult if I were talking about him. Although maybe the fact that I'm so disappointed it's not him should help me reach my verdict. I know I have a duty to the world, but I can't be forced into having feelings for someone. If I meet potential number three and there's nothing, I'd be crushed. If I really disliked him, I'd be devastated. In my silence, Holly reaches behind her. When she brings her hand back to her lap, she's holding a Rubik's Cube, identical to the one I just left in my room. Where'd you get that from? I ask, glancing behind me and wondering how long it'll be before Vivian comes marching along to reprimand me and drag me back to my room, or whether they'll simply decide to switch Bram off. It's fine. I've cleared it. It's mine. Oh, I understand. There's no way she'd be holding mine. Hers is like her, here, but not. Holly laughs, just as loudly and freely as before. I love that laugh. I figured it would help to clear your mind. This place in the clouds, your silly little gadget, it'll help. Despite myself, I feel the corners of my mouth twitch into a smile and my own frown easing away. You can't touch it, though, she warns, her voice stern while her eyes twinkle. She's pleased with herself for thinking this one up. Oh? I reply, my breath catching in my throat. You just have to tell me what to do, she explains, licking her lips and looking at the cube with an intense glare, as though she's entirely focused on the task ahead. You know I've always been rubbish with these. Now you might actually complete one, I tease. I've done it before, remember? She says, the pitch of her voice raising an octave in protest. Only because you painstakingly removed all the stickers and cheated, I laugh, feeling my body tilt towards hers. I got what I wanted, though, didn't I? Sometimes a little cheating is good for the soul. It made you feel good, I ask, finding his response surprising. Well, it did until you sussed it out and made me confess.